I do my show on the Heritage Radio Network because I think it's important to talk about the impact of technology on our lives.
I do my show to reach home cooks and help them do better.
Because I love getting together with people in the industry.
I like hosting my show because, to me, it's the stories about people and their relationship to food that help make the food more interesting and more delicious.
Our hosts do their shows as a labor of love, but we still need your financial support in order to keep the lights on and keep the tape rolling. Please become a member today at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Nettle Meadow Farm Cheese and Spirits Pairing, taking place on Saturday, June 18th at Nettle Meadow Farm. For more information, visit nettlemeadowcheeseandspirits.com. That's Nettle meadowcheeseandspirits.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to The Main Course without Patrick Martins on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Alexis McLaughlin, here as always with the bleary-eyed but still handsome Philip Gilmore.
Bleary-eyed?
It's a little early for us.
It is kind of early, yes.
Very excited. We have Anya Fernald on the with us today in the studio. Anya is the founder and CEO of Bel Campo, as well as the author of the new Home Cooked, Essential Recipes for a New Way to Cook. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning.
Did you guys hear the drop on the intro, the Nettle Meadow?
Yeah, what is that?
It's a farm and a cheese place. But it immediately thought of the rural juror, the gag on 30 Rock. Do you watch 30 Rock at all?
Not much. Not recently.
It's she's filming a new movie and like no one can understand what she's saying because it's like rural juror. Uh-huh. It's like Nettle Meadow.
Nettle Meadow.
Anyway. Hi. So how's your trip? How's Bushwick treating you?
It's great to be back. I lived here back in the late 90s, so it's nice to see the changes.
It's amazing how everyone has like a strange Bushwick connection.
I was just thinking, the same years you lived here, what's his name? Rainn Wilson lived here. We had him on the show a few months ago, and he was saying he lived literally about three blocks that way towards the Montrose stop in like 97, 98, 99.
It was perhaps the most fashionable and uncomfortable period of my life.
Oh, yeah.
Those things go hand in hand in my mind.
Yeah, right?
So you got your start in food kind of young. It was just, you grew up with in California where it was, the farm to table, or at least.
Well,
farming was
I did mine my past for my book and learned, to my surprise, that I actually bust for money at the first farmer's market in America in Eugene, Oregon when I was five. So how's that for early beginnings?
Wow.
But yeah, I was, I don't know quite why my parents, now that I have a four-year-old, I don't think I would put her with a violin at the farmer's market. But my parents thought that was a good idea. I think that Eugene, Oregon is probably a little more chill than Oakland where we live now. But that was what I was doing when I was five. So
what was your second job?
I know. Paper delivery route in Palo Alto. But yeah, then I moved to California, and we always had a garden, that kind of thing. I've just always been interested in food and wanted to work in the field as soon as I could. I went to college mostly to appease my parents and didn't think I really wanted to go into culinary school after working in a couple kitchens. So I moved to Europe and first worked as a cheesemaker. And then worked on rural development through basically small business development. So there's kind of a through line in all my work in my 20s of working in small businesses, not in the restaurant space, but primarily artisan, small quality businesses in Europe and then back in the States.
Were your parents like cooking at home all the time? Were they into food at all? Or?
Not much. I got into cooking primarily because I wanted to feed my family. I mean, it was just a way to kind of bring my family together and my parents were both working a lot and we had a garden, so I cooked from that. Yeah. And I just enjoyed the ability to make things happen and make everybody happy.
Yeah, I kind of, same story with me. I kind of, my parents worked a lot and I had, bunch of little brothers, so I kind of like was always like just, you know, cooking in the kitchen out of necessity, but then like enjoyed it. Yeah,
absolutely. No, it was for me a real passion, and that's been a fun thing. And now I run a pretty big company, small in the grand scheme of things, but in the sustainable food space, it's pretty large, and it's a, you know, it's a lot of stress and pressure and big goals and pushing hard every day. And, you know, you lose track of what got you into it in the first place sometimes. So it was great to write this book and really get back to what it is that drew me into the space initially. And also, the book is just all recipes that I've, there's no development of recipes for the book. It's just everything that I cook and that I learned to cook over the years. And that's kind of, I sort of put in everything that's gotten me compliments over the years. People are like, how'd you make this? This is so good. So all that stuff that's gotten thumbs up, I just put that in. And it was, so it was very, very easy to write. You know, it wasn't like a development process. It was just basically a brain dump of everything that I like to make at home. And
like, you're like 100% your wheelhouse.
Exactly. And I've always said, I'm never going to do another book. I mean, of my recipes, I'll do a meat cookery book for Belcampo. I'll do other brand related things, but this is just, I don't have any more recipes and I'm not going to go make them. So it was really just my own experience. And so it's very much for the home cook. It's not a chef type book. It's not about things that scale well for restaurants, or it's not a take a version of something I've made for a restaurant that's done for home. It's just stuff that I've made really successfully in a home kitchen. And that I think is achievable for home cooks, but also challenging. You know, the goal was to put some things in there that weren't just the basic.
Is there anything in there? How can I phrase this? Is there something that in the cookbook that's like, you were cooking when you were 12, or something that's from your childhood, or
so
early
much of,
on?
Yeah, I feel like my
one
whole
thing that's the oldest.
Yeah, absolutely. There's some buttermilk biscuits from working as a baker, but that I actually initially learned from my grandma.
Oh, wow.
And there's spoon bread, which was the first thing that I learned to make. To my grandfather grew up in the South, and I remember him telling me about spoon bread, so I made it for him when I was 12.
Amazing.
And always started making that. But, you know, a lot of what my really, I think I really learned, relearned cooking and eating in living in Sicily in my early 20s. Mm-hmm. And I lived in a very, very rural part of Sicily where a lot of food was still gathered. So on weekends, we'd all go hiking and get asparagus and greens. And it was actually just a big source of calories for people. I mean, they actually gathered still a bunch of their food. Everybody had a garden and an orchard. And I lived in this really rural community. It was sort of, you know, it was the early 2000s. It was still in the area where it was like cool for them to go to McDonald's. For them, that was the aspirational thing. Yeah. Like, you know, it was that sort of topsy-turvy world. And it was the first place I saw people who were, like, the poorest people in that town ate the best. And sort of the upside down of America, where, you know, the poorer you are, the less access to good food you have. Where there, the poorer you were, the more likely you were to have a garden. Kind of like how it was for our grandparents. You know, our grandparents stopped canning because it was a sign of poverty.
Yeah.
Not because they were too busy. You know, like there were bigger socioeconomic kind of forces in play. So that was a really amazing experience for me. And a lot of what I learned just about the simple kind of techniques of cooking. It's also a neat thing about living there is in Sicily was that people were preparing food kind of all the time and then always had something ready and homemade in the fridge. You know, so you'd have people come over and then they'd pull out two things from the fridge and cook something else up there or have something on the fire. And I learned a style of just sort of keeping base ingredients ready and having sort of lovely homemade things prepared or easy within access. That's always really informed how to be a gracious host, you know, and how to kind of live comfortably.
Yeah.
I think that's what I really loved about the book, about your book most, is that as much as there's, you know, recipes in it, it's also just a nice approach to cooking that we've gotten away from, where it's just, you know, have certain things ready and available, or just, you know, approach food simply, but, you know, with a, like a whole food take on it.
I'm kind of done with that, unless it's somebody that's very special occasion and it's somebody wants me to cook a very specific thing. But I hate, you know, when you want to cook something and then you read the recipe and you realize you don't have one of the things.
Yeah.
And then you have to, you know, oh, I have to go out and buy cream of tartar now. And I have to, you know, I have to go buy this, you know, and then, and, you know, you go to the grocery store and then, you know, you have to buy these 12 things and you're going to use them once. And, you know,
a lot of the recipes now, I feel like just with the boom in chef driven cookbooks, you know, restaurants have somebody there standing there making your food right before it goes on the plate.
Yeah.
And so when restaurants write a cookbook, it's all stuff that you need somebody standing in the kitchen to make.
Yeah.
And for me, I want to be drinking wine with my guests or hanging out with my kids. If I'm, you know, I want to be at the table, not the one in the kitchen. And I've been to people's houses when they're making some complicated dish and they're so frazzled and stressed out by the whole experience.
Yeah.
So my goal was just like make stuff that's actually helps you relax. And, you know, things like I got into making cocktails at home. I think a lot of people have done that recently and didn't like the shaking the cocktails to order for everybody. And then as soon as they've been around, you don't get your drink because you're making everybody else their next round. And so I just started to make them in batches and figure out cocktails that hold well in the fridge. So those are some recipes I have where, like, you make 8 drinks at once, put it in a big, you know, pitcher or mason jar or something in your fridge, just pour it over ice. You can make it the day before. So a lot of the recipes are about that approach. Can you make stuff simply and just be able to focus? Nobody's going to come to your house for the culinary experience of a lifetime. They'll probably go to your restaurant, or they'll go someplace like that. So, like, you should be focused on letting your guests and letting your family having that time to enjoy your time together, which is really the focus of cooking, right?
If you do the cocktail thing though and shake it though, my advice would be put out a tip jar. It just feels better at the end of the night. You feel like you accomplished something when you're counting your tips at the end of the night, you know. And you also get to see who's your real friend and who's not. You know,
It's the Food Network revolution where everyone's watching these, you know, competition shows and have kind of gotten away from home cooking or don't. It, you know, it's not supposed to be stressful.
Well, you know what I'm dealing with now, and I'm not the first to talk about this. I've read a lot of articles in the last year, but there's really a drought of cooks right now in New York City, especially.
Oh, completely.
It's so hard to find a good cook, and it's because everybody who's a cook thinks that they're going to be the next famous chef, and it's like it's so sad. Like people don't know what it used to be like 20 years ago, you know, where you actually put in your work, you know, I don't know.
Well, it's also not really a passion. I've noticed that there's two tracks of cookbooks now. There's cookbooks that are like avocado toast recipes and, you know, sort of like mix something with something and put in a crock pot recipe. Mm-hmm. And then there's really, really fancy, like day one, prepare these 5 things. Day two, you know, kill the pig. Like they're too super complicated.
Take out a refrigerator 5 weeks later.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so it's like there's this gulf. And I mean, I've gotten the question a lot of like, why didn't you just do a grilling book? It's a no brainer. You run a meat company. And I will do a grilling book down the road. I could write that in my sleep, right? It's going to be a pleasure to do that. But I wanted to do something that inspired people to look at cooking as a hobby again, because I found it to be so gratifying and like relaxing and just a way to chill out. It's an easy, kind of affordable, simple hobby. And I wanted people to get inspired to think about that aspect of cooking and get them back into the kitchen just for pleasure.
So I had a dream about you this morning. I swear to God, I did. I told Alexis this. It's really funny. I actually figured out. I told Alexis. I have a friend that posted something on Facebook about making a fish sauce, and it was right as I was going to sleep. And then I kind of like, you know, just thinking about the questions we were going to ask you. So I was just reading your Wikipedia page, and then I didn't have the cookbook, and I didn't know. You know, I just saw the cookbook this morning for the first time, and I didn't know what the cookbook. And I was wondering like, what's the cookbook going to be about? And so I dreamed that you did a cookbook about fish sauces.
Oh wow.
And then I remember like you had the book in here and you were saying that you were in Vietnam and you were like, you know, they would bury it in pots in the ground and and I was like, so tell me about the most. I thought you did a book about fish sauces, so that's not true, right?
He made a fish sauce like really from fish and salt.
No, it was just a picture that I saw.
Oh, okay, got
online
it.
Like, oh, I'm making fish sauce for the first time.
I've been tempted. I went to Phu Quoc to go see the fish sauce factories when I was in Vietnam, and I was like, that's the kind of project that I would do, but it would make my house smell really gross.
Oh, and that matched with actually Makuni Wild Harvest just started carrying Red Boat, which is the best fish. You know, Red Boat? Mm-hmm. I can drink that stuff. That's so good.
What's the Red Boat? Is that
Japanese? It's basically, no, it's a guy, I think, in California.
But the product's Vietnamese. It's from Phu Quoc.
Yeah.
Actual product is.
Yeah. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. But it's kind of the, I don't know,
just a great
Rolls Royce of fish sauce. But it's so good.
Yeah, it's delicious.
It's amazing how every culture has a fish sauce.
Yeah,
there's even an Italian one.
Yeah,
I use a ton of anchovies, and that's sort of, there is a Italian fish sauce, which is just basically the juice that comes off of salted anchovies. It's concentrated. It goes back to garum, right? Mm-hmm. And I, in Piedmont, learned to cook with a lot of salted anchovies, especially for anything with meat, because they're traditionally used anchovies for salt, because salt was very expensive. Yeah. And salted fish was like a more affordable salt. Basically, gave you, spreaded your salt dollars out. So I've learned that a lot for just my cooking. I do a ton of grilling now, especially at our farm. And I have everything I do with any kind of like grilled pork or grilled flank steaks or hangers, especially with the grass-fed meat. I find salted fish just brings out the flavors in a great way. So I should probably experiment with fish sauce as a shortcut.
You have to try the anchovies that Heritage has from Jean-Luc.
Oh, I've bought those.
Oh, I'm sure.
They
are
just the best. They're so good. Of course you have, but it's like literally like I'm an anchovy junkie.
Yeah.
And I think the ones with the garlic and parsley.
They're so good.
Garlic and chive.
Yeah, garlic and chive. I think that's the best anchovy I've ever had.
Yeah, they're amazing.
And I've had anchovies all over the world.
My daughter can eat a whole jar of the Ortiz ones. Ones, just straight. She'll eat them just with a little fork. She loves that.
If I get a Caesar salad with boccheronis again on it, I'm gonna throw the plate at the wall.
Dude,
I'm so
done.
Like don't. No, it's a Caesar salad, and it's cute that there's little silver, and they only give you this many. No, I want brown anchovies, please, on my Caesar salad.
I hear you.
Yeah.
Okay. There's your next
Caesar salad. Worcestershire too is kind of a fish sauce, I guess, if you think about it.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. We did a Worcestershire on our farm with the anchovies, and it was funny when you actually make the real old fashioned ones. It tastes a lot fishier than the Worcestershire does today. I think they've kind of toned that down.
Yeah.
But it's delicious. Tastes. I mean, it's a really classic pairing with meat. I think, especially when people were using free range meats, that pairing holds up more. You know, it's more obvious. I found that with any type of grass-fed beef, the richer, beefier flavor. When I've done our steak sauce or other fish-based sauces with non-grass-fed meat, it kind of overwhelms it. It doesn't have enough oomph to hold up to it. It's got more fat, but you don't really need that when you're with the fish. With the fish, you want that beefy flavor to kind of meet the fish umami.
Yeah. And wow, I'm just like, my mind's going crazy right now thinking about, you know, because I really love like some sort of like fish and meat together, but like thinking about doing some sort of like homemade Worcestershire sauce, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's all like the fermented fish-based kind of sauces that are the backbone, and that is the
is Worcestershire flavor. A proprietary thing? Is that no? You can anybody? Just
I can
make
send you what we did. It was anchovy and tamarind was the base that we found.
But can you call it Worcestershire sauce if you put it? Or is
no,
it Lee and Perrins?
That's
Lee and Perrins.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, that was the challenge for us in marketing, though.
Oh, really?
We're like, here's the Bell Worcester. It didn't work. wait. We're no longer making it.
if I saw a sauce that said Worcester, Massachusetts sauce, I'd be like, no, thank you.
Yeah.
I've been to Worcester. Gross. No.
I want to talk a little bit about Bel Campo, because that's super interesting. Vertically integrated farm, processor, butcher shop, and restaurants now. Everything in one.
Yeah.
And you guys focus on grass-fed beef. Are you raising other livestock?
Mm-hmm. We have pork, lamb, goat, and all the poultry species. So we've got lots of chickens.
What kind of poultry are you doing?
We have meat birds, eggs, guinea fowl, geese, ducks, turkey, and quail.
Wow.
And we do our duck and geese seasonally, and quail and guinea fowl are basically on special order. We just haven't gotten enough demand.
I've been using, do you know, I'm embarrassed. It's Muir Farm, M-U-I-R. This lady, Jennifer Grossman, it's been the Catskills.
Oh, okay.
It is so special. I've been getting my guinea hens from her,
nice.
It is just the best thing I've ever had.
Yeah, it's amazing for me. You know, that's the one thing with the absence of home cooks that we've found that we can sell the quail and the guinea fowls a bit in the restaurants. In our restaurants, we have 7 restaurants in the company, and they'll move somewhat, you know, on a salad kind of thing. But to a home cook, we only will sell quail and guineas to Europeans. They just don't come in and buy. I think it may be a West Coast thing. I'm not sure, but we've dialed those back because we don't sell the restaurants much. So it's been interesting to me that there's a lot of fear around spending money on a meat that you haven't cooked before.
Yeah.
People are just not comfortable with tackling that. So I've dialed those back significantly.
Well, luckily I have a place that does a lot of ramen, so when Jennifer sends me a bag for free, like Christmas presents, with 30 pounds of feet, I'm like, yes, I can use this.
Yes.
if I got that in my house, I would it would sit in my freezer for probably
exactly
2 years.
I think
I'd
that's
throw
the
it
issue.
Out.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, when
buy
you're
feet,
familiar.
Boil, make chicken soup.
Exactly.
The best.
So we actually, I mean, our biggest kind of growth areas in the company now are things like bone broth. So doing semi-prepared stuff has been huge for us.
Yeah.
And we do, of course, sell a lot of raw meat out of the butcher case. The butcher cases are just beautiful. I try to think of them, or like when I look at the creating the vibe in the butcher shop, I want it to be not the place that your grandmother actually shopped at, but how you in your fantasy life where your grandmother shopped at. You know, like sort of your idealized version of a 1940s or 1950s butcher shop. So we really focus on making, you know, the customer experience great and just making people where they are. You know,
when you say bone broth, you're selling it for the...
Frozen, like, and by the cup.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, like by the cup to drink?
Yeah.
Yeah, we've really... I think it's kind of too late now, but I think like this next winter we're going to do that. Like almost like, not necessarily an amuse-bouche, but like when you sit down, the first thing we're going to do, it's, you know, it's 0 degrees out. You walk into the restaurant, the first thing, you know, do you eat meat?
Yeah.
Yes. You get some bone broth.
It's just amazing.
Just a sip. You know?
People have come in. It's not who you expect. You know, there's a lot of like people who are yoga devotees coming into our Santa Monica shop every day for bone broth, but it's a lot of older people, a lot of cancer survivors, people who have had a serious health issue and are absolutely convinced that bone broth has been part of their recovery process. So it's been a neat for me because it's like, and that's the thing, it's like I'm leaving aside some of the specialty poultry and things. It's really saying people want bone broth, we make more bone broth. You know, we're trying to get to where we can find a way for good, healthy meat to meet people where they are and basically make it easy for them to incorporate. So we sell a lot of like 12 and 20 ounce hot to go containers. We do turmeric shots in it. We put ginger in it. We do like some like nice little inclusions, mixes, chili sauce, stuff like that. So whatever they want it. But that's been a huge growth area for the butcher shops.
Wow.
I get secretaries and I guess I'm not called that. I mean, like assistants coming into our office and into our shop in San Francisco and taking away like 8 cups to go for the team. Like it's pretty amazing. And to see it's no longer going out for the coffee order.
So sometimes when we're making the stock for our chicken ramen, we get really great, you know, hair. Birds from, mm-hmm. And all we do, you know, we take all the meat, make yakitori and the skin, and then it's basically just like the bones. And just tasting that, the broth with no salt, no nothing, just the broth and the fat is just like it, you just drink it and you just get like,
yeah,
you get, that's like a cup of coffee. It's amazing.
It's so amazing, and it really does great things. I think for skin and hair and nails, all that collagen and gelatin.
Yeah,
they say that. I mean, I've been doing research because I've been trying to say like, be able to give my team talking points like, why is this healthy? And I mean, frankly, there's no research. Like a lot of things in the alternative health and farming movement.
Don't do Botox. Drink bone broth.
Well, that's what people say. They say it really helps your skin tone And the only real data out there is about effect on basically, you know, like your healing mechanisms. Mm-hmm. It seems to help that. So that's great. I mean, you should definitely do the broth. People will love it.
Broth it up.
Yeah. Is that the paleo people out in the West Coast? Or it's a kind of a variety of...
So the paleo people, it's really the broth is a post-workout thing. So when you've really like lifted a lot of weights with the way that broth can help you heal, it's part of your recovery. So that's a small segment, but it's mostly people who are like, we get a lot of people who've been through illness and some sort of like a lot of people who've been through cancer use it and or are on chemo. So it's basically really restored. And also people who just had the flu. I love it when I've had the flu. I just dose it with tons of chili and lemon, especially if you're not eating very much. It's just really restorative and delicious and kind of fill you up. It's also something people do who are losing weight, wanting to lose weight because all the collagen, it really fills you up, even though it doesn't have many calories. So that's kind of the demo. So we've done ads on Facebook, which is bone broth equals bikini body. It's one of our most successful Facebook ads. I was like, this is a new world. I love it that I could advertise it that way. But it worked. So people came in.
So when you put turmeric in it, do you use powdered turmeric or fresh turmeric?
I use fresh turmeric juice. Ugh. And it's actually this crazy company in Malibu, of course, that gets this amazing Hawaiian organic turmeric. You know how turmeric can taste soapy?
Yeah.
Apparently in Hawaii, it's not.
Sweet.
And so it's so mild.
Their ginger, too. Their ginger isn't so spicy. It's really sweet.
So we put those shots in. I feel a little bad about the carbon footprint on that. I don't know if they're flown in or what, but it's so delicious. The turmeric makes it like savory. And turmeric's supposed to be the super, super food now,
I love turmeric. Fresh turmeric is my favorite.
So good for you.
I the first time I used it, though, I didn't really know you were supposed to wear gloves. So
it's contentious in kitchens because it stains everything so much.
Yeah, like everything it touches stains. It's worth like 10-20 times worse than beets.
Yeah. I don't cook with turmeric at home because I would literally stain everything.
Go like.
Yeah, it's supposed to be. It's like this health tonic for vitality and youth, right? Turmeric.
Yeah, I was reading something though. It's really important. I could be mistaken, but when you eat turmeric, you have to add black pepper into it.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
is it Ayurvedic or?
But like scientifically, there's something that the curcumin, what is it? There's something in turmeric, but if you eat it with black pepper, it's like works twice as good for all the health benefits.
Just, okay.
Yeah.
Duly noted.
You heard it here first.
Okay. This is your health guru show.
Or I made it up.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll be back to talk more with Anya Fernald.
Okay.
Cheese and Spirits Pairing is a celebration of good food and beverages in the newly restored Barn Loft event venue at Nettle Meadow Farm in Thurman, New York. On Saturday, June 18th, come sample and savor, then buy your favorite cheeses and beverages to take home. Nettle Meadow cheeses have been praised highly in national media and have won prestigious awards from the American Cheese Society. Taste samples of goat and sheep cheeses paired with an array of local regional wines, beers, and ciders. You'll never forget your first sample of rich, creamy Kunik, Nettle Meadow's trademark cheese. In Esquire, our very own Ann Saxelby said, "Kunik, it may very well be the sexiest cheese in the USA." Nettle Meadow Farm is a goat and sheep dairy and cheese company in Thurman, New York, just below Crane Mountain in the Adirondacks, between Gore Mountain, North Creek, and Warrensburg. It's owned and operated by Lorraine Limbiase and Sheila Flanagan. Both have a great love of animals, artisan cheese, and the unique challenges of farm life. Nettle Meadow Farm was originally founded in 1990, and it's the home of over 300 goats, dozens of sheep, and a variety of farm sanctuary animals. Again, the cheese and spirits pairing is Saturday, June 18th. For more information and tickets, visit NettleMeadowCheeseAndSpirits.com. That's N-E-T-T-L-E, MeadowCheeseAndSpirits.com.
A veal campaign.
Welcome back to the main course. We are talking with Anya Fernald, talking about some fish during the break. I don't know how that came up.
Yeah, fish.
From meat to fish.
Yeah.
Organic fish. I never even considered what that means or what that would be.
It's organic certified feed, so it has to be farmed.
Okay.
That's the challenge. So that's all I know.
But then
about
you
it.
Have other issues with farmed fish.
I think there's a lot of concerns about farm fish. I think the organic regs are different for fish than for other species land protein sources because they do have mandates around the environmental impact.
Yeah.
So one of the criticisms of like organic dairy is that you can have an organic feedlot because there isn't actually part of the organic directive that explains that you have to have animals out on the grass.
Well, that's what I tell people about Heritage is that, you know, that I'm so proud to use all of their products is like, you know, you can throw something in a box and there's a tube that comes out and it squirts slop on the ground, but the slop is organic, yeah. So now it's certified organic. It doesn't really talk about, you know, how
people
the animal's treated.
There's a lot of subtlety in that, yeah. You know, but we're 100% certified organic and our slaughter is certified organic and we're all grass-fed and finished and everything else that, you know, you want products to be. But it's been amazing to me. I didn't think that organic was going to be a big part of our market at Belcampo because what we're doing is so far beyond that. You know, it's a whole different level. But it's the number one thing that our customers ask for. It's organic. So it's been interesting for me. It's been a learning curve for me. And I think it's because that, you know, a lot of people in their first step in their kind of food journey about eating good quality food is they understand organic. And that's something that's relatable. So we've now made the decision to take all of our sausages and salamis and bacon 100% organic certified. Down to, you know, before we were just using organic meat.
Yeah.
And now it's important enough for our consumers that we're doing organic hot dogs come, I think, July they're going to be launching.
Wow.
It's one of those frustrating things for me being in the meat industry, like just getting that organic question over and over again.
Yeah.
Because I just want to tell people, like, maybe that's not the most important question we should be asking right now. You know, like it's the right question when you're talking about vegetables. But when you're talking about meat, like there's, you know, welfare, animal welfare.
That's my most important thing. That's what I'm most, you know, I think like, you know, if it's humanely raised, humanely butchered is like the most important to me.
I agree. It's interesting though that we have that as we have Animal Welfare Association approval for all of our farm and our slaughterhouse as well. So we have a certification for both. I'd say that it's 90% interest in the organic certification.
Yeah.
The 10% is just for the leading edge people that we have the welfare certification as well.
And it just kind of sucks though because it's kind of like just like a talking point. It doesn't like it's just like a selling point. You know?
Yeah,
but it makes sense. You know, that's
it's beautiful. It's beautiful
to ask.
It's beautiful that people know about it. But you know, I guess so.
I think that I've gotten on the certification bandwagon in the past 3 years, just seeing what customers want, and also seeing that you know I get to claim a pretty big premium for organic. And for the style of production that I do, it's like if you're going to ask for that premium from people who are giving you their money, you should pay the premium on the back end to guarantee it.
Absolutely.
You know, so for me, it's like I've kind of changed my thinking. I used to feel like, wow, it's an extra, you know, $2,000 just for the certification, and then it's probably $5,000 of extra stuff you have to do and paperwork you have to fill out, and it's like, well, you can charge 30% more.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
You know, depending on your scale, it kind of pays for itself pretty quickly.
Well, you know, I have like this, the demographic here is so like the highest and lowest in this neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So it's funny because, you know, if you go to one of my billion Yelp review things, the overland, it's either one of two things. People will say, oh my god, this place is so expensive and overpriced, and then the other half is like, oh my god, I cannot believe like how cheap this place is.
Yeah,
because it's like, if you know what you're eating, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, yeah. Oh, that's micro shiso, dummy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We get the same thing. It's funny for me too, we get pushback on price primarily around our burger, and our fancy burger in our most expensive location, which is San Francisco, just because the rents are really high, I think is like $18 at dinner, which is an expensive burger, but it's not like the most expensive burger. And at most of our locations, the bistro burger is $13, and we always have an $8 burger as well. Mm-hmm. So for me, that's a high priced burger, but it's not the Mount Everest of burgers.
But it's a decent restaurant, and it's for dinner.
Yeah, and you're sitting down, and you have table service, and you get free water and all that other stuff. But it's funny to me that, you know, the expensive steaks and the expensive stuff, and you really get the price sensitivity around the stuff that has easy comparables, I think, out there. And so it's interesting to me in terms of the pushback around that's one concern I've always had playing in the burger space. We have two concepts that are two of our restaurants are just burgers, and the price issue is just so immediate there, whereas in other things, it's just people don't even ask that question.
Yeah,
it's crazy to me because it's like the burger. You're really going to think that's an expensive burger when you have other stuff.
Pasta is nothing,
right? Yeah. And that to me is like, why wouldn't you make a stink about the other stuff? The salad is actually, when the ingredient ratio is actually way more expensive, you know. But
yeah.
I think it's like when you have the comparable in your mind, you're kind of
you're conditioned.
The $11 salad only weighs 3 ounces,
I know, exactly.
And the burger,
it's like on a per calorie basis, you realize you're getting really ripped off on the salad.
Yeah, exactly.
That stuff gets sold, but it is interesting to me that there's so much. The comments we get are like the burger,
but
so
there's just more colors in the salad.
Exactly. It's crazy.
Yeah, but you can't go to McDonald's and get a salad.
What do you serve the burger with?
We serve it with tallow fries. Mm-hmm. So we fry our tallow. We actually fry the fries in about like 15% tallow because you know, it's like with all tallow, it gets really, it's very difficult for the fire to work.
Yeah.
And the fries also get, they cool really quickly and they get a little waxy.
Yeah.
So we use a ratio of tallow from our farm. And then we do a century burger in which is our 100-day aged grind. So I actually take the whole leg of the beef and age it not with the skin on, but with all the extra muscular fiber, which is basically, you know, those big, it's silver skin. It's the white, thick, muscular coating. So it really protects
Nature's Ziploc bag.
Exactly. So it's a 100-day age, but it's not raunchy. You know, and also the great thing about that round is that you don't have a lot of intramuscular fat. It's in big load-bearing muscles. So it gets really tender and it develops a lot of mildness, but it doesn't develop a super gamey flavor.
Yeah.
So we serve that actually with shaved tallow on it to kind of bump up the beef, shave fresh tallow on it. And we shave fresh tallow on those fries as well. So we do sort of a special thing there. You know, that's actually our most expensive burger because that's a pretty expensive product for us.
Yeah.
And it's got an amazing flavor. And I love the beef fat, bumping that up a bit on that one.
Do you remember when me and Dustin and Izzy dredged a quarter of a Wagyu for 180 days?
Yeah.
Yeah,
you guys went through a whole dry aging
phase.
Fun time.
We dry aged some Wagyu for it was literally, I don't know, like 5-6 months.
Uh-huh.
And it was but
did you do a tallow cap on it?
Nope.
We just did it straight up.
And then, but it had like literally like mold growing on the out of it. So me and Dustin dared each other and we actually just said, fuck it. And because, you know, nobody has ever died of mold. Supposedly, mold can't kill you.
Yeah.
You know, bacteria can. So we actually just went for it and we each did a slice of the mold with the fat and ate it. And it was like just straight up beef fat blue cheese. And it was amazing.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that beef fat flavor, you know, fat is flavor, and so the aging on those fattier cuts is where you really get that cheesy experience. And it was actually Mario Batali when he came to our restaurant in Santa Monica, because we have a product line together, so he came and had dinner there, and we served him, I think, a 70-day aged steak. And he gave me great advice, which was just serve people like 2 or 3 slices of this.
Yeah.
Don't, because you really enjoy it for the first bite or two, and then it's really overwhelming. It's like all of your There's a name for it. I just learned it. It's your secondary flavor threshold, which is like all those funky antioxidant and mold and ripeness and all those phenols, that the buttons that they hit, mm-hmm. they get overwhelmed really quickly.
Yeah.
So it goes from being like this most amazing over the top taste experience of your life to being really unpleasant, like on bite four or five, unless you're an outlier, you know, unless you're like on the bell curve of lovely extreme flavor. So now we serve those steaks in our restaurant. We'll do 4 ounces for a table.
Wow.
And
amazing.
We just, so that's like people all get a bite or a bite and a half and then they're done. And that's actually the perfect amount, you know, because it's like, you don't want to eat the whole steak.
Yeah.
Even though it's incredible.
Like 1 ounce of super intense, stinky cheese. Good. Yeah. 4 ounces bad.
Exactly. You don't
or even anchovies. As much as I love anchovies, I can eat anchovies by themselves, but not 10 anchovies, but one or two. Great.
And that's actually one of the theories about obesity, is that we have so many bland foods available in America so widely that we don't hit that secondary flavor threshold fast enough because everything's been so dumbed down and made so like childish in the palate in terms of what's widely available. So I read that and it was like, it was really interesting to me of that idea kind of intuitively makes sense. Like we have so much bland calories available that you don't get full because you don't hit that threshold. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't hit those other things.
You're
that
not
are
like flavor satiated.
Yeah, they did a study on goats showing that when goats eat these like herbaceous, really mixed pastures, they eat much fewer calories than when they're fed just plain bland whatever grain, and they're healthier, but they're getting, you know, less calories, but they get satiated, they stop eating sooner, which I thought was, that's the only research I've read about it, was this one thing. And you obviously can't generalize from goats to humans, but we do sell 99% of our DNA, so maybe.
We actually had an author on the show, Mark Schatzker, who wrote the Dorito Effect.
Oh yeah, that's where I got the stat.
Doing that kind of research, and it was super interesting, and I never really considered it much, but you know, we've taken a lot of nutrition away from the tomato by, you know, making it grow, like demanding that it grows faster, and you know, the colors there, and the,
you know, I'm
the
like completely anti-tomato.
Forever?
No. I mean, I love a great tomato, but I hate tomato. Well, first of all, the organic thing. Mm-hmm. Like tomatoes, I think it's either tomato or strawberry, but tomatoes, you know, ounce for ounce have the most pesticides in them if you don't eat it organic. So not only that, but then just like, you know, I love a good tomato, but besides that, I just don't, like, I never eat tomatoes.
I'm the same
ever.
Way. I don't want a tomato on my burger in most cases.
Or a salad, like unless it's like a beautiful tomato.
That was a huge decision point for our company because our first burger, the Belcampo cheeseburger, which is our classic burger, we didn't put a tomato on it because if you don't have a perfect tomato, what's the point, right?
Exactly.
And you only get a perfect tomato in California 2 months of the year, maybe 6 weeks some years. So we actually did a sauce. We did a bunch of other stuff on it, but we didn't put the tomato on by choice. Then we would launch our Fast Burger, which is our In-N-Out style burger.
Yeah.
And that's been a huge success for the company, but we basically had to cave and put the tomato on it.
Yeah.
And it was really kind of this heartbreaking moment. It's like you're that classic, like, you know, principles versus
cheap, you know, like a fast food burger or like a cheap burger. You know, I'll eat a tomato.
But tomato plays a different role in that, though. It's just like the crunch, it's the water, it's the freshness. But I hear you on the tomatoes.
I think we're in the same school. I like pickle, onion, lettuce. That's it.
Yeah, me too. If I do have a tomato on a burger, I want, like, especially like a fast food style burger, I prefer like a light, like a quick pickle tomato and then slightly dehydrated. Because for me, you lose everything with that, like, too much watery texture, sogs everything
down. Also
often
if you're using really mealy tomatoes too.
I only eat German spider tomatoes or Japanese black tomatoes on my burger.
I'm from Florida. I love tomatoes. I love it, like, nothing more than like a summer tomato sandwich.
Yeah.
Like mayonnaise, white bread, tomato, salt, pepper, maybe a slice of cheese.
I did do one recipe in the book that's good for using if you do get mealy tomatoes or tomatoes that are too watery. That's just to grate them over a box grater, like what you grate cheddar on, like a big grater. And just as you grate them, just hold them with the stem side up and the peel will come off on your hand. This is something I learned from like Italian housewives. They always cook tomatoes this way. And you just grate on the box grater, and the pulp will come out. It's all seedy and, you know, broken down for you. And then you just toss it with olive oil, cook it down for half an hour, 45 minutes, and it makes a great fresh sauce. So if you do end up with those tomatoes, that's one thing that I always do. If I'm like, get the bummer tomato batch wherever I bought it, I'm like, okay, I can just at least cook them down. You can toss it in the fridge, you can use it, cook eggs in it, use it with pasta, whatever you use tomato sauce for. But that's a great, you can take the bad out of the tomatoes by cooking them down.
I love the grating. Anything I can grate at home. I grate garlic all the time because
I hate
chopping it.
It's so nice, nicer. Just an easier thing, one less appliance to use. You know, it's so simple. And also you get a lot out of those big summer tomatoes. You can grate them and just two or three, and you can have dinner for four with some eggs, you know, simple.
I love that idea.
Do you like penne? Do you like penne arrabbiata?
Yeah, I do.
It's my favorite.
It's yummy.
It's my go-to thing.
Yeah. One thing I put in the book is a sofrito recipe to how to pre-make it and keep it in the freezer.
Nice.
Which is something I use for things like arrabbiata. You know, it's like, how do you make those dishes taste like restaurant quality? Mm-hmm. Taste really good. It's like, well, they have all these bases. You know, there's some things that you can do at home that, that make it easier to kind of create, make those simple things the best things.
Well, I lived in Rome, as we were talking about before, and that's my thing is like, I would always go to somebody's grandmother's house or mother's house. And that's like kind of like maybe a go-to dish in Rome is arrabbiata. And but it was like, I think the key is this extra olive oil. They would pour like literally like 3 cups of olive oil in, and then just so when they and then garlic and the pepper and and onions. But then when you throw the tomato in there, it just like fries.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I know that's what I learned from really watching Italians cook. It's like you just use a lot more oil,
and you use a lot more oil. But then the great thing is that they don't. It's not like a bun, like a lot of sauce. They just kind of lightly toss the pasta in sauce.
Exactly. It's so good. Yeah, my go-to along those lines is carbonara. Of course, running a meat company, I have a lot of bacon.
Yeah.
And that's another one I learned, just, use more fat than you think, and it gets so much better.
We're actually, we have a dish. It's called a, we call it it's like an uni mazaman ramen.
Uh-huh.
So it's ramen, and we toss it in, and we just do a little bit of butter and cream. And then do you know mentaiko? It's like the spicy cod roe from Japan.
Okay.
It looks like the little, tobiko, but it's actually very soft, like caviar, but it's this bright red, spicy cod roe.
Mm-hmm.
So just buttercream, the mentaiko.
That's my favorite dish.
And then we toss in fresh cooked ramen noodles, homemade. Mm-hmm. And then we put uni and shiso and nori on top.
Oh, wow.
But then everybody kept eating it. It said it reminded them of a seafood carbonara.
Mm-hmm.
So we said we should put peas in it. So instead now we're putting edamame. But... But it's kind of like, but
that
it's so delicious.
Yeah.
It's so amazing.
Talking about pasta and funky fish things. Yes. On topic. We always stay on topic here at the main course. Yes.
We're known for it.
Well.
Well, everyone at home should check out Anya Fernald's new book, Home Cooked, Essential Recipes for a New Way to Cook.
They can buy it on all the thingies, Amazon and all that. Sorry to interrupt you. Will you repeat the title again?
Home Cooked, Essential Recipes for a New Way to Cook by Anya Fernald.
David, please edit out that interruption, the rude interruption. Can we edit that out, David? Yes? Yeah, okay,
good. Anya, thank you so much for sitting down with us today.
Thanks
really
for having
appreciate
me.
It.
Yeah, yeah, thank you guys so much.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.